I've always been fascinated with the idea of human endurance. What are we actually capable of doing? And it's almost always a lot more than we think. At some point, I want to do a long-distance bike ride. So far, the longest I've biked in a day is about 50 or 60 miles, and that was right here in this area, so afterward, I went home and slept in my own bed. But I'd really like to bike from here in the Tampa Bay area across to the other side of Florida, the East Coast. It would probably take me like 3 days. I love the idea of that kind of adventure. But my guest today, Daniel, had a much bigger idea. His plan was to ride his bike across the entire U.S., from San Francisco all the way to New York City. And he started this ride without carrying any money or any food. He was going to depend on the kindness of strangers all along the way. And that's exactly what he did. But that's not all. He recorded video all along the way, and he turned that into a documentary that's won a ton of awards. So we get to see him struggling to bike up mountains and across long stretches where he saw no one, and through some scary neighborhoods. But my favorite part, and what made Daniel's journey so magical, are the people he encountered along the way. Real people in unreal situations.
There is a girl hanging by her broken leg from the telephone wire.
And I called 911 and I said, I found a baby.
I turned around. I see a gun pointed at me close enough I could touch it.
She would hold our heads underwater all the time.
He levels the gun, pulls the trigger, and I go down.
Her eyes were full of tears. She didn't want to leave us.
My hair catches on fire.
I swear to God, this image is burning my head for the rest of my life.
I'm Scott Johnson, and this is What Was That Like? Hey, it's Scott, and guess what? You're about to hear an ad. And that's both good and bad. It's good because ads are what make it possible for me to keep bringing you these episodes. And it's bad because, well, maybe you don't like listening to ads, and I get that. And the good news is, you don't have to. When you sign up to support the show, you get every single episode without any ads. Plus, you get all the bonus episodes. Yeah, did you know there are actually bonus episodes? And you can try it all for free just to see what it's like. If you're on an iPhone, just go to the What Was That Like podcast and at the top, click on Try Free and you're in. On Android, just go to whatwasthatlike.com/plus and try it out completely free. Once you've had the ad-free experience, you'll see why hundreds of other listeners are already doing it. But for now, here's another ad and then on with today's episode.
Hey. Do you have trouble sleeping? Then maybe you should check out the Sleepy Podcast. It's a show where I read old books in the public domain to help you get to sleep. It was the best of times. It was the worst of times. It was the age of classic stories like A Tale of Two Cities, Pride and Prejudice, Winnie the Pooh. Stories that are great for adults and kids alike. For years now, Sleepy has helped millions of people catch some much-needed Z's, start their next day off fresh, and discover old books that they didn't know they loved. So, whether you have a tough time snoozing or you just like a good bedtime story, fluff up the cool side of your pillow and tune into Sleepy. Unless you're driving, then please don't listen to Sleepy. Find Sleepy on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts. New episodes each week. Sweet dreams.
Do you remember a specific moment when you came up with this idea, or how did it come about?
I think if anything, it kind of starts from my childhood, honestly. I think that, so growing up, my mother, she really struggled with alcohol abuse and drug addiction. I didn't have much of a connection with her. She ended up dying at a young age, and it never really gave me the opportunity to get to know who she was as a person, and I felt that lack of connection with her. And that was kind of instilled at me at a young age. And then my father ended up passing away at a young age as well. After those two things happened with me, I really started to question life and just what I wanted to do with my own life. And again, just that lack of human connection that I felt with my parents being gone. And around the time that my father passed away, somebody gave me a book called The Kindness of Strangers. And it was about a guy who hitchhiked across America with no food and no money. And he wrote a book about all the people that he met along the way. And after reading that book, I felt so inspired. And I thought, man, I would love to kind of recreate something like that. And because, you know, after my father passed, I just felt like this sense of recklessness in me of really wanting to do something, because I felt like, well, shoot, I thought he was going to live to be a lot longer. Same with my mom. And I realized, who knows how long I'll be around for. So yeah, that book inspired me. And I thought, instead of hitchhiking across America, what if I were to, you know, try to ride my bike across it? Because I think that when you ride your bike, you really connect with the communities that you're riding through. You get to know the land very well. Like when you're climbing over the Rocky Mountains on a bicycle, you really feel the Rocky Mountains and you smell the areas that you're going through. And being on a bicycle, it attracts curiosity from people. You know, they see that you have your bags and they think, where is this guy coming from? Where's his story? And I thought, you know, that would give me an advantage if I was making a documentary, because I figured, you know, I would have this unique opportunity to connect with the people that I met because of the curiosity that they have. And so I kind of combined that recklessness that I was feeling and also that sense I wanted to really push it, because who knows how long I'll be around for. And that's pretty much what inspired the journey.
You mentioned your documentary, and I watched it. Actually, I've watched it twice, and it's amazing. We're going to have a link to that so people can watch it. But some of the questions that I have are, it's kind of divided into two groups. One is the social aspect of it, who you met, what, you know, who did you encounter and how did that all work? But also, I'm really interested in the logistics of how you do this cross-country trip and make a documentary at the same time. So, man, I just got all kinds of questions. But let's talk about, what was the original plan? You're in San Francisco and you were planning to go from there to New York City. Was the round trip part of the plan, or how did that come into formation?
The original plan was to try to get to New York City with no food or money, you know, and I had a sign that said biking across country, ran out of food, anything helps. And then I was panhandling, right? And I decided to use hidden camera glasses because I didn't want the people to know that I was making a documentary in the moment, because I was trying to capture the real, genuine interactions that I had with people. If I was fortunate to receive help from somebody, I'd say, hey, do you have a story about when somebody helped you when you really needed it? And I started collecting stories about people's hardships and compassion that they'd experienced in their own lives, you know, and I was trying to figure out, why are these people helping? Like, what makes them want to help? And so, yeah, my goal was to get all the way to New York City from San Francisco. And I remember standing at the Golden Gate Bridge when I left San Francisco, and I was staring at it and thinking, oh my God, I have so far to go. And I felt this sense of like panic for a second, because I thought, how far? The Brooklyn Bridge is like 3,600 miles away from here. And it was really intimidating. But what I found was, as soon as I started pedaling, I immediately felt better, because I realized, just take it one day at a time. But that was the goal, was just to get to New York City. And I got there and I felt like, well, I think I want to keep going.
How far in advance did you plan this? How long did it take you to put it all together?
I'd say about a year in advance, I really started looking at different routes, et cetera. And again, going back to the recklessness in me, I wanted to choose the most challenging route that I could find, because I really wanted to push myself. And again, it was kind of like a moment of just, I didn't care what happened really, because I was feeling so reckless. But I feel like I channeled that in a way that was positive, because I wanted to make something, you know, about compassion and adventure, et cetera. And so that's why I chose a route, you know, over the mountains and through the deserts.
How long did you think it would take?
I thought that I would get to New York in about 2.5 months, but I quickly realized that, I mean, just the time that I would spend panhandling each, you know, every couple of days, I would spend like 8 hours out there. And also, I realized that sometimes I would have a connection with somebody in a town and I would sit there for 3 hours and just hang out. So that kind of changed my schedule as well, is because who knows, sometimes I'd meet somebody and they'd say, hey, do you need a place to stay for the night? And I'd end up in a stranger's home having dinner with them, which is really beautiful.
Right. Yeah. I love that part of it. You just said, okay, I'm going to meet somebody. I'm going to hang out with them for a while. And you met some really interesting people. Can you summarize your inventory of stuff that you brought with you when you started? What did you have?
I had my Surly long haul chucker bicycle, which is a touring bike. It's able to hold a lot of weight and gear. I had about 60 pounds of gear. I had my hidden camera glasses. I brought a drone with me to capture the landscape shots. To program the drone, I would use my phone and use the GPS on it, and I would program it to where it would follow me. So it gave you some really cool landscape shots, and it seemed like I had a film crew with me. And then I brought a GoPro camera that I strapped to my chest when I was riding to give that first person view, to make the viewer feel like they were there on the bike with me. And then I brought a tent, a sleeping bag. I brought some cooking gear, a water purifier, and I had some change of clothes. That's pretty much it. The camera gear is what weighed the most out of anything.
Did you forget anything?
You're going to think this is absolutely ridiculous, but I left and I forgot my jacket. And so I had my brother meet me in Santa Cruz, and he brought the day that I left, and he brought the jacket for me.
Yeah, because you did run into some cold weather for parts of this trip. You definitely wanted a jacket, I'm sure.
Yeah, definitely. And the one thing with my gear is I because I wasn't planning on being on the road for too long, I only brought summer gear with me. But because I ended up spending 7 months on the road, I definitely wasn't prepared for winter. And when winter came and I was in Montana, I mean, I was, you know, trying to use my summer gear to stay warm, and that really wasn't helping too well.
Okay, but when you started out, you left San Francisco, you literally had no food with you and you had no money in your pocket?
Yeah, there was no food or money. And I just had my sign that said biking across country, ran out of food, anything helps. But you know, one thing, Scott, I will mention is I read a book by an environmental activist named Rob Greenfield. He rode his bike across America and he was dumpster diving a lot of the way. And so I knew he was going behind grocery stores to find food that was being thrown away. And so I knew that was an option that was always going to be like a backup option if I needed it, which gave me more confidence.
In watching the documentary, it seems like in a lot of cases, that was plan A, right? Because you hit a lot of dumpsters.
Yeah, yeah. You know, Scott, it was really interesting. I had no idea that there was that much food being thrown away. I mean, it was insane. And there was actually at times where I would prefer, especially as time went on, sometimes the panhandling could just be so mentally exhausting, and I didn't want to stand out in public for 8 hours, you know? And so it was a lot easier to go behind a grocery store and just grab some food that was in the dumpster, and then I would just keep going on my bike.
Yeah, you're still self-sustaining, so to speak. So, but 8 hours is a long time. When you started this, did you plan on spending that much time at each place just to get food or money?
No. I thought it was going to be a lot less, honestly, but I would stop every 3 days though as well. So like I wouldn't stop every day for 8 hours. So it was 8 hours would give me the opportunity to give me enough food or money for about 3 days or so. Obviously it depended, but that usually I felt like, okay, I have enough to where I can keep going. And it also gave me a chance to rest in some ways, rest my legs. So it was like a day off from riding the bike.
So you started on the California coast, and is that where you live?
Yeah. I live in Monterey, California.
Was there any publicity? Like, how many people knew you were doing this?
You know, what's really funny is I hardly told anybody I was doing it besides my close friends and family, because there was this level that I wanted to be like anonymous on the road, and I didn't want people to know what I was doing. For example, there'd be times I would meet other people on bike tours who were going across the country, and they would say like, hey, do you want to ride with us for the day? But I'd actually decline because I felt like it was going to kind of get in the way of my documentary and my story, etc. So there was this level of anonymity that I tried to maintain the whole time.
From the time you started, how long before you stopped to ask for donations?
The first time I stopped was about 45 miles. Yeah, I rode 45 miles the first day, and then I met a man in Santa Cruz. It was really interesting. He kind of foreshadowed. It was amazing. He told me, he said, I asked him, what made you want to help me, man? He said, you know, there's this quote that I learned at a young age because I went through some struggles myself. And he said, you know, I don't give because I have a lot. He said, I give because I know what it's like to have absolutely nothing. And it was really fascinating because he was the first person that I met, and he pretty much foreshadowed the whole journey for me, because that's what I started to witness as time went on.
I know you didn't put every person that you encountered in the documentary, but I remember seeing that guy.
Yeah.
When you stopped that first time, how nervous were you to start standing there holding that sign?
Oh man, I can't. Yeah, it's hard to explain. I felt so self-conscious. I had no idea about just how much shame and guilt I would feel by holding a sign that was pretty much asking for help. And it hit me immediately. I mean, the funny thing with this journey is, like, I really didn't have much of a plan at all. I just figured, okay, I'm going to go ride my bike and just really just see what happens. And so when I finally received help from someone, the first thing that came to mind was like, hey man, like, do you have a story about when somebody helped you? And that was like spur of the moment. I just thought that about, and then I just ended up sticking with that question the whole time.
That is such an amazing question. I can't believe you just, it was just right off the top of your head, you just decided to ask him. What were you, so you weren't planning to ask him anything?
Not really, no. I didn't really know what to say. That's the funny thing about this is again, like, in some ways, I think that I wanted to keep some serendipity with this whole experience. And that's why there wasn't so much planning as far as the route goes, or even, you know, every night I didn't know where I was going to sleep or what town I was going to stop into. And that created a level, it kind of increased the adventure, and it just felt more authentic. And I kind of felt like I was evolving with just the flow of the journey, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah. Where did you camp on the first night?
Yeah. The very first night I didn't know where I was going to sleep, and I slept behind a baseball field. And that's another thing that's just, again, kind of funny. I came across the baseball field. I thought, oh, this seems like kind of a safe place to sleep. And then as time went on, that was always kind of my go-to option if I couldn't find like a place off the side of the road or in the woods, especially in these more like condensed cities. The baseball field, I would hide out in the dugout, and it gave me some safety, and it kept me from the rain. And the other funny thing too is, I mean, you know, I was always trying to find a place to bathe, you know, and sometimes I would jump in a river to bathe, but other times at baseball fields, once it got dark, I would just strip butt naked and just use their hose and just be showering in the middle of the baseball field. This random bike rider who's naked showering, you know.
I would be thinking, okay, I'm out miles from home. I'm naked in a baseball field. What am I doing with my life?
Yeah, you know, that's so funny. And there was also, it's kind of liberating in some ways, because I just like really wanted to get into the primal aspect of it. Like, I also, like, I hardly wore a shirt the whole time when I was riding my bike, because I felt like, you know, and I grew a beard, and it just, I really wanted to be in the lifestyle. And just, it's kind of exciting where you just, while you're riding across, you know, different states and different areas, you're always kind of looking for resources. What can I use to kind of help guide me along this, whether it's using the dumpster, right? Or if you're, you know, you're using the baseball field, or you're jumping in a river, or you're sleeping in weird places, you know?
Yeah. What were some of the more unusual places you slept? I know one of them was a graveyard, right?
Yeah. Yeah. That one was in Pennsylvania. I was riding near the Appalachian Mountains, and it was this like rural area, and it was getting dark. And I came across, next to an abandoned house, there was this small graveyard of maybe like 15 graves. And I thought, well, this is the only place that's flat around here that's like had decent grass. So I set up my tent there, and that was a pretty memorable night. And, you know, there was a kind of a funny one. I was, when I was in Colorado, there were a lot of wildfires happening. For a couple of days, I was trying to outrun these wildfires because of all the smoke, you know, and eventually the smoke caught up to me, and for a couple of days I was breathing in that smoke, and it was really starting to hurt my lungs, especially 8 hours sleeping in a tent. I came across this old football equipment shed behind this high school, and I thought, you know, it's summertime, so it's totally fine if I just sleep in this football equipment shed. And there was soft pads that I put on the ground, and I really got a good night's sleep there, and it kept me from the smoke. And then the next morning I wake up at like 8 a.m. and I load my bike up with all my gear, and I walk out of the football shed, and there's this football team, like 40 players that are practicing, I guess, summer practice. And everybody literally, it was like a movie. They stopped the practice, and everybody's just staring at me thinking, what the hell is this guy doing coming out of the shed at 8 a.m? Like, was he sleeping in there?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'll bet they were talking about that for a while.
Definitely. Definitely.
And did you sleep on a high school roof?
Yeah, that was actually the third night. So basically, I was near Davis, California, and I set up my tent in this baseball field at first, but there was cockroaches. I woke up in the middle of the night and there was cockroaches everywhere on my tent. And also they got in my tent. It was so disgusting. Like, and there was no way I could fall back asleep, just like knowing they're crawling all over. So I didn't know what to do. Again, I woke up at like maybe 2 a.m. And so I just like grabbed my stuff and I hopped on top of this fence and I threw my gear on top of this roof at this high school. And I slept up there, and it was very, very strange place, but also a memorable place. It was kind of cool to watch the sunrise being on top of the roof there.
And then there was another time you slept inside a tree.
That was probably the best night's sleep I got in the whole 7-month journey. I was riding through Northern California through the redwoods, and it started to rain in the late afternoon. And so I thought, okay, I got to find a place that will keep me dry. And I came across this redwood grove, and I'm talking huge redwoods that are like 1500 years old. And one of them, the bottom of it was hollowed out. And so I set up my tent inside the tree. It was such a huge tree, I could stand up with no problem inside the tree. And in some ways, I mean, it kept me dry from the rain, and it also kept me warm. I know this is going to kind of sound a little hippie-ish, but like in some ways, I felt like the 1500-year-old tree was nurturing me in some ways, you know, and I slept so good that night.
You do have a little bit of a hippie streak in you, right? I mean, that's what it sounds like anyway.
That's definitely in me for sure. Yeah.
Okay. So you're going on and you're like 3 days in and you had your first bike repair issue. Something went wrong with the bike and you had to hitchhike. Had you ever done that before?
No. That was my first time hitchhiking. And again, I didn't know what I was doing. I just didn't know how long it would take or whatever. And the crazy thing about that is I set my stuff down, right? Because my seat broke and I can't ride, you know, a bike with a broken seat. And I thought, okay, like, we'll see what happens. I walked to the side of the road, two cars passed by, and the third car, so literally it was 15 seconds, the third car picked me up. And it was unbelievable.
And that was the guy in the little van, right?
Yeah, he was in a Westfalia van. And he said, you know, it'll break your heart if you're hitchhiking and a Westfalia van passes you by and doesn't pick you up.
That guy was hilarious too. I mean, because yeah, I guess you guys were going up a hill or something. He had it all the way to the floor and it just wasn't making any progress hardly. And he's swearing at the people honking at him. And
yeah, he was such a funny guy. He was in his mid-80s and this Sicilian guy, and that's how we bonded. I'm Sicilian. He was Sicilian, and his old van was so old and broke, you know, beaten up, and he was driving so slow to where there's this huge line of traffic going, you know, and he was talking to me, and then, you know, a bunch of people are honking, and he stops his conversation and he goes, "Fuck you, asshole." And then he just goes right back into the conversation like nothing happened.
He's used to it probably, right?
It sounds like it.
Carson Pass in Eastern California was over 8,000 feet elevation, and you were really struggling. Did you train for that kind of elevation?
Yeah, that's one thing where I did. I worked with a physical therapist for 6 months before I left, and she was really trying to get my body nice and strong for that mountain pass. And that was the big test for me. That was the first really big mountain pass that I faced. And it was a struggle, and I had to take a lot of breaks while I was riding up the pass. But eventually, I got up to the top of the pass, and it was so beautiful because I got up there. It just felt, it was up into the snow, and then just as soon as you descend that pass, you know, you cross the border and then you're in Nevada. And it was amazing because, you know, 20 minutes earlier at the top of the pass, there was snow and pine trees. And then after 20 minutes of riding, all of a sudden I look around and there was cactuses and you're in the desert.
You know, there are some stories about my mom's life that I never get tired of hearing. Like when she and my dad first met, it was on a double date, but they were each dating other people. Or years later, when they thought they were all done having kids, and she found out she was pregnant again. She has tons of stories, and I'll bet the mother figure in your life does too. That's why, a little while back, I gave my mom the perfect gift that captures all of her life stories forever. It's called StoryWorth. Here's how it works. Each week, your mom gets an email with a thought-provoking question, like, what was your favorite childhood pet? Or, what was your first job? And all she has to do is reply to that email with the answer. It can be a long story or a short one, doesn't matter, and you'll get a copy of each response, too. My mom loved going back and reliving those memories. And after a year of these email reply stories, StoryWorth compiles all of them into a keepsake hardcover book that's going to be in your family for generations. So for Mother's Day, skip the flowers that'll be dead in a week, and don't you dare do a gift card.
Give all the moms in your life a unique, heartfelt gift you'll all cherish for years. StoryWorth. Right now, save $10 on your first purchase when you go to StoryWorth.com/what. That's StoryWorth.com/what to save $10 on your first purchase.
I don't know how many other people do this, but I like to plan my weekly meals. Maybe I'm just weird, but I like quick and easy. That's just one of the benefits you can get with Cook Unity. Go to CookUnity.com/what or enter code what before checkout to get 50% off your first week. One of the dishes I recently had was the Green Goddess Falafel Bowl. Oh, I loved it. The falafel was seasoned perfectly, and I love how crispy it is on the outside, but really moist on the inside. It's a signature dish of Enat Admoni. She's known around the world as a chef. You've probably seen her on TV, and her dishes are made right here in Florida, so I'm supporting local business, and I love that. And the convenience of Cook Unity is crazy. I mean, I've got podcast episodes to produce. I don't have time for cooking. These meals are delivered fully cooked. So when it's time to eat, I pick a meal based on my mood for that day. I heat it for a few minutes and enjoy. The menus are updated every week, so there's always something new to try. You can choose from over 350 meals based on your dietary needs or taste preferences, or go wild and have Cook Unity pick for you, because every meal is just amazing.
Make the best meal plan ever with the convenience, chef-level quality, and endless variety of Cook Unity. Go to cookunity.com/what or enter code WHAT before checkout for 50% off your first week. That's 50% off your first week by using code WHAT or going to cookunity.com/what.
Something I've been recently making a deliberate effort with is to read more. There are lots of books I want to read, and I try to read every day, even if it's just a few pages. A little bit each day adds up, and it can make a big difference. It's like taking care of your gut. Even though it's not big, it supports the health of your whole body. Seed's DS01 Daily Symbiotic benefits not just your gut and your heart, which aren't outwardly visible, but your skin too, which you can see. Every morning it's the same thing, two capsules of Seed DS01. And sometimes I wonder, is it normal to feel this great? It helps support digestive health with optimal gut bacteria levels. And thankfully, that's all backed up by science, and all the supporting data is on their website. If you're trying to avoid sugar, soy, peanuts, or gluten, you're good to go. And I was reading the literature and I thought, you had me at vegan, because it's that too. And if you have kids, DS01 is the first multi-strain symbiotic shown to be tolerable and health-promoting in a cohort of children aged 3 to 17. And you can use this promo code to give it a try.
Trust your gut with Seed's DS01 Daily Symbiotic. Go to seed.com/what and use code 25WHAT to get 25% off your first month. That's 25% off your first month of Seed's DS01 Daily Symbiotic at seed.com/what, code 25WHAT.
There's nothing quite like the feeling that you get when you've been working 5 hours climbing up a mountain pass and you have all that gear and you're sweating, you know, and you just want to get to the top, and then you're rewarded with this wonderful feeling of just adrenaline rush as you're just bombing down the mountain. And that's when I feel the most alive, when I'm riding my bike, is just going fast down a mountain pass. And in some ways, you know, you look at the mountains and there's this challenge, there's this obstacle in front of you, and it's you think, can I do this? Can I ride over this? You know, and I like to kind of make a game out of it in some ways and look at it as this obstacle that's in my way. And can I, in some ways, conquer the mountain, if that makes sense? And when you get over the top of it, and it just feels like it's a moment of celebration to just feel the wind in your face and just give your legs a break and just also, it's like it usually when you get to the top of the mountain, you have a wonderful view and it reveals where am I going next. And after crossing Carson Pass and being in the, you know, the pine trees, I realized, oh, I'm heading down into the desert now. I crossed the Great Basin Desert in Nevada. They call it the loneliest road in America. And this particular road is about a 400-mile stretch with only four towns. There was 18 mountain passes to climb, and it was super intimidating going through there. Before I rode through the desert, this man told me, he said, you better be aware of the scorpions. He said, there's a lot of scorpions if you're going to be camping out there. And he said, watch out for the coyotes too. And he warned me about running out of water. And so I was feeling pretty intimidated before riding into the desert. You know, there was one particular day that really stood out to me. There was an 84-mile day with three mountain passes to climb, no services, and I think the most intense part was there was no shade. And so I woke up with a certain kind of intensity that day and thought, okay, like, respect the desert because this is no joke. You know, you got a long way to go, especially carrying like 60 pounds of gear. After a couple mountain passes, I had 35 miles left to go, and I ran out of water because this hellish headwind hit me. It was really slowing my pace down. And when I ran out of water, I got a little nervous because I had still had 35 miles. And then my nose, I got so dehydrated that my nose started to bleed. And that's when I got really concerned because I thought, okay, now I'm losing a lot of electrolytes, and that's getting me super dehydrated. And, you know, as I kept riding, I started to feel like I had the flu, felt super sick. And what made it even worse was, you know, being out in the desert, just along the side of the road, there was just tons of like carcasses from dead animals, that just like dead cows that wandered off and just died of thirst, dead horses. And so that definitely didn't, you know, increase my, my confidence as I'm, you know, out of water, seeing all these dead animals. And, you know, eventually I was able to make it over the third mountain pass and, you know, and get out of the desert. But that was a super intense part of the ride, and one that I'll never forget.
Talking about where you were planning to go, I assume you used your phone for GPS the whole time to track your route.
So I used I purchased these maps by Adventure Cycling Association for the first about half of the trip for the western part of the country, and they were kind of like more cycle friendly roads, if that makes sense. They would take you. It was a longer route, if that makes sense, but it would keep you away from traffic for the most part. And so I used those maps up until I got to St. Louis. And then when I got to St. Louis, I started using my phone for GPS. And again, I just knew, okay, I'm heading towards New York City, so it's just going a general direction. But there was also a lot of times where I would ask people when I was panhandling, hey, are there any cool roads that you'd recommend just going east? And that was a cool way to kind of get to, you know, the locals would fill you in on certain roads that, you know, the GPS wouldn't normally pick up on.
How did you keep all this equipment charged? Did you use solar?
Yeah, great question. So I had a solar panel on the back of my sleeping bag. So on the back of my rack, I would strap down my tent and my sleeping bag. And then when it was sunny out, I would just strap the solar panel on there to charge some stuff. And then also every couple of days, I would stop in the local library and I would charge my stuff that way. And that was always cool because I just like the vibe of different libraries. And like, I got to know a lot of different libraries going across the country. And it just a really good feeling going into a local library, especially in these small towns and maybe a couple hundred people. And it's just, you get this chance to connect with, you know, the people who work there, and it's just really special.
Yeah. Yeah. Libraries are amazing. They do so much. You met new people pretty much every day, but did you ever experience loneliness on this trip for yourself?
Yeah, there was loneliness. And I think that it was because of just, you know, I grew a beard on purpose because I wanted to see if that would change the way that people treated me. And without a doubt, it was, yeah, very obvious. And it was way more effective than I thought it would. When I was more clean cut, you know, I felt like I was more approachable. But as my appearance was changing, I noticed that people were stopped. They wouldn't make eye contact with me as much. I was receiving much less help. And even when I would ask the question, hey, do you have a story about when somebody helped you? You know, in the beginning, people were open and receptive to that. But as I had a long beard, people, it's like, here's $5, but kind of don't talk to me. You know, I want to do my good deed. And then that was it. And so I definitely started to feel lonely, and kind of like, as I was standing out there with my sign, in some ways I started to feel invisible in a way. And it really made me think about just people who live that lifestyle every day, how lonely that could be.
Did you see any other people holding signs like that, like actual people that are homeless? And I'm wondering if they would say, hey, this is my territory, you know?
Yeah, really interesting point that you bring up is, you know, on the West Coast, I definitely saw a lot more like homeless people who were holding signs. And I learned that there's some kind of territorial thing going on and you could feel it. Like sometimes I would be holding my sign and then I'd see somebody else that was holding a sign who was actually homeless, and I would get a look and I knew like I need to leave here for numerous reasons. First of all, you know, want to be respectful. That's their real life and I'm just choosing to do this. So, and then also that it did feel dangerous at times because it did feel like this is, like the guy was saying, in some ways, this is my territory. Like you're taking away from me eating or me getting some money. So they're definitely, it felt threatening at times. And so I definitely felt that tension.
What kind of food did you find in dumpsters?
Man, I couldn't believe the amount of fresh strawberries and bananas and apples. I mean, that was just a staple for me, especially in the summertime. I mean, and I'm talking fresh, like there's nothing wrong with these, you know, and they weren't even in the compost bin, they were in the dumpster. But a huge staple for me was bagels. There was always bagels being thrown out, and like, you know, you get a lot of carbohydrates from the bread there. You know, I ate a ton of peanut butter and jelly, and the bagels were always a good option. I came across steaks. I came across tons of yogurt.
Did you have a way of cooking the steaks?
I did, yeah. On the back, on the top of my my cooking pot, you could flip it over and you could use it as a little frying pan. So it was pretty sweet. That was amazing. And then the eggs, you know, eggs stay good for so long. And so I would just hard boil, you know, I come across a carton and cool, I got a dozen eggs here. I'll just hard boil these and I can just be snacking on these for the next couple of days.
I would think you must have been conflicted at some point because, you know, when you look in a dumpster and you see a dozen bunches of bananas, I mean, you can only eat so many at one time, but yet you don't want to bring all of them with you for tomorrow and the next day because you think it's more weight and plus they're going to go bad.
Yeah, that's so funny you mentioned that because I definitely felt those moments. The first time I started dumpster diving, I just loaded like as much as I could, but then I realized the two things you mentioned. First of all, my bike felt super heavy after that. And then I realized I just can't carry this much food. There's not enough room. And it felt like it was too much. So, and I'm talking literally, I can't stress enough, like I'm talking dumpsters that were full of food. It was unbelievable and shocking.
The first time when you pointed the camera in there and all those bins of strawberries and they're all just fine. It's amazing what we throw away.
Yeah. I think our country, we're afraid of, you know, the grocery stores are afraid of getting sued. So they don't want to take any chances at all. And so they just throw away the food.
I want to talk about one of the people that you met. I think one of the earliest, well, maybe not one of the earliest ones, but the one that really struck me, this woman named Fabiola. And where was she? Where did she live?
That was in Kansas City, Missouri.
Okay. All right. And she actually invited you into her home. And I mean, my listeners know that one of the things that I really love is talking to people and having a really heartfelt or deep conversation. And you had that with her that night. That must have been amazing.
Yeah. You know, Scott, there were certain moments along this journey that like it felt like it was fate to meet some of these people, if that makes sense. Because with Fabiola, what happened was I was riding through Kansas City. I had my shoes on the front of my bike strapped down and I dropped a shoe. So I turned her and I realized it after a couple minutes. So I turned around, rode my bike. It was at the stoplight. And at the stoplight, this woman named Fabiola says, "Oh my gosh, are you on a bike tour? Where are you coming from? I'm so excited to see you." And just really quickly, I said, "I'm Daniel. I'm coming from San Francisco." And then the light turned green and then she sped off. And then I went to go panhandle in a different part of Kansas City 5 hours later. And Kansas City is a big city, right? And like, it was probably, you know, 10 miles away from where I met her. And then I ran into her again. And I thought, oh my gosh, you know? And so she, we had a chance to talk and Fabiola said, you know, "Do you need a place to stay for the night?" And I thought, oh my gosh, like, absolutely. Like, how incredible is it to be welcomed? You know, especially I've been sleeping outside in a tent for the last couple of months. And she ended up, I had dinner with her and her family. She was from Nicaragua. So they cooked some nice Nicaraguan food. And you know, after dinner, I sat at the dinner table with her and I said, you know, Fabiola, what made you want to stop and just start talking to me and, you know, invite me into your house? And she said, you know, I saw you on your bike tour and it made me think about my husband. And she said, my husband's dream was to ride across the country. He didn't get a chance to do that because he died of cancer when he was 40. And she said that I saw you and I wanted to celebrate my husband's spirit. So I felt like I wanted to do something kind for you in honor of my husband. So that's why I welcomed you into my house. And it was really beautiful because when I first met, she was talking about growing up in Nicaragua and, you know, obviously speaking Spanish and growing up poor. And, you know, I didn't grow up with either of those things. I was fortunate. I wasn't poor throughout my life. And I've been pretty privileged, you know, growing up in California. But it made me realize, you know, when she started talking about her husband who passed from cancer, and she started telling stories about what it was like, you know, those couple of years that he was struggling. You know, my father passed from cancer. And I remember as she's describing these stories, I started to think, oh my gosh, like I have these same emotions. I went through these same human experiences that you did. And it made me realize that, yeah, we grew up differently in these different cultures, but we shared this common human experience of grief over losing a loved one. And that was just so beautiful because I instantly felt way more connected to her that way.
You know, the perfect ending to this story would be you and Fabiola are now married.
I know, right? I know.
But that didn't happen though. Have you had any contact with her since then?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. The really cool thing is like throughout this whole process with putting out the documentary, anytime it was in a film festival, et cetera, or showing for different places, I'd always reach out to the people that are in the film and helped me because, you know, it wouldn't have been possible if it wasn't for these super special people. You know, they helped create this story. And so anytime I have the chance to connect with them, I do. And the really cool thing is I've stayed in contact with almost every single person who you see in the film, which is super special. There's a couple of, you know, homeless people who I wasn't able to keep in contact with just because they lived, you know, kind of that transient lifestyle. But most of the people I still talk to.
That is so cool. You know, really, I loved watching all the interactions between you and the people who wanted to help you. And so many people said, hey, I've been through tough times and people helped me. Was that kind of a common theme?
Yeah. And that kind of goes back to where we were talking about the very first person who I met who said, I don't give because I have a lot. I give because I know what it's like to have absolutely nothing. I really started to see that going through impoverished neighborhoods. You know, for example, I was riding through Dayton, Ohio, you know, and this guy comes up to me. His name is Shorty, right? And Shorty says, hey, like here's a couple of dollars for you. I said, thanks, man. I was like, do you have a story when somebody helped you and you needed it? And Shorty goes, well, shoot, man. He said, you know, right now I'm going through kind of a tough time. He said, you know, I don't have a job. I'm homeless. And he said, but God got me. He said, it's not to our understanding, but there's a bigger plan for your life. He said, sometimes you got to go with it. And he said, ups and downs, got to keep on smiling. And he said, you got to help another brother out is what he told me. So inspiring because it made me look at my own life and made me realize how much I actually do have. You know, witnessing this homeless man who is literally doesn't have a job and is sleeping on the streets, but he's still willing to help somebody was really beautiful, you know, and he wasn't the only homeless person that I met who ended up helping me. I mean, there was obviously, as you see in the film, there was numerous homeless people and it was really beautiful to be able to witness that.
How do you think this trip would have been different if you were not a white man?
Yeah, I think it would have been tremendously different. And the reason I say that is because, I mean, within the first week when I was riding through the Sierra Nevadas, this very nice man, as I'm riding past his house, said, do you need a place to camp? And I said, yeah, that sounds great. He said, you can camp in my yard, man. Thank you, man. That's super kind of you, you know? So I stayed there for the night. And then the next day he said, you want to go on a hike? And I thought, oh, for sure. This is great. I get to see the area a little bit. And he's showing, we're on this hike, you know, and I'm feeling very welcomed. And then pretty much out of nowhere, he just starts going on this rant about how he hates black people. That was just very eye-opening to think, whoa, like, okay, so he's being super kind to me. But if I was like a black man riding through this area, then it could have been totally different. And it wasn't just that. I mean, there was other situations I witnessed as well. I mean, you know, riding through a lot of areas of the country and just seeing the northern parts, it wasn't like the south either. It was northern parts and even California, seeing Confederate flags, a lot of different places. And there was a man I met when I was riding from New York back to California, and he was a black man. We were sharing stories, and he said, "Where you been camping at most nights?" And I said, "Oh, you know, man, like most nights I just sleep in baseball fields." And he said, "Cops don't bother you?" And I said, "Yeah, well, you know, sometimes they come, but they usually just tell me to leave early in the morning." And this man said, he looked at me, he said, "Oh my gosh, man." He said, "Last week I was staying in a campground where I was supposed to be staying, and someone still called the cops on me, you know, and then there was something, you know, there was a moment I had in Idaho as well, where I was, in a rural area in Idaho, and this guy in this big truck pulls over and he says, "Where are you going?" And I said, "Oh, I'm just going to the next town. You know, I'm riding my bike." And at this part, I had a long beard and I was looking a little different than when I first started. And he says, "Where are you from?" I said, "I'm from California." And he said, "Phew." He's like, "You shouldn't admit that to people around here." I said, "Okay." And then he goes, "You know, we're all carrying guns around here, right?" And then he just like stares at me and slowly drives off.
That is creepy.
Yeah, for sure. And that was an area where there was Confederate flags and things like that.
You know, when you were setting up some of the shots while you were riding, there's a still shot of you, the camera's in one place and you're just biking past. Now, yeah. I know the typical viewer might just look at that and think, "Yep, he's riding by." But I look at that and I think, you had to stop and set up the camera in that spot and then backtrack like 50 yards or so and then bike past it for the shot. And then go back and retrieve the camera and go on your way. So,
yeah.
You know, making this documentary, it really added to the difficulty. You're not just riding across the country. You had lots of other things to think about along the way. Was that always going through your mind, what the end product is going to be like?
Yeah, that was what's confusing at times, because in some ways I'm trying to stay super like engaged and present as far as just riding my bike and witnessing these things. But at the same time, I'm thinking, this could be a good shot here. So I'd stop, you know, kind of stop the moment, set up my camera. Sometimes I would set it up on a rock or something, you know, just use, again, be resourceful and try to use what you can. And there'd be other times where I would stop and set up my drone and program my drone to follow me. But I definitely, it was kind of a blessing and a curse at the same time, because in some ways, I mean, when days were boring, it kind of gave me something to look forward to. It's like, as far as just, if I was having a day where just the scenery wasn't changing very much or whatever, I would always be on the lookout for kind of a cool shot, and I'd break up my drone and that would kind of give me a little energy. But at the same time, there were moments when I was just really present and having a great time and just having to stop and feel like I need to film this shot. It kind of took me out of the moment a little bit.
And you were a one-man crew. It's not like you were bringing a film crew with you that could set up the shots and look at the dailies at the end of the day to see, you know, see how it all went.
Yeah. Yeah. I really wanted to prove to myself that I didn't need a film crew. I mean, you and I, before we started the podcast, we were talking about that there's something very empowering about knowing that you can do it all by yourself, you know, and we live in a time right now, which is pretty cool, to where, you know, one person can literally just make their own movie, and it's really special. And, I also, again, I wanted it to be raw and real, and you know, the idea of bringing a crew with me would totally not be a true experience.
Overwhelmed by investing?
If you're anything like us, the hardest part is getting started. That's why we created the Investing for Beginners podcast.
Our goal is to help simplify money so it can work for you.
We invite guests to demystify investing.
At least try to be setting aside like the minimum 10% into the 401k.
We'll teach you the basics of the market.
Yeah, I think compound interest should be at the start of any discussion about investing. And
we've had investment professionals who teach in a simple way.
A valuation-driven bear market. You know, we haven't really seen yet, and I think everyone's thinking about it, but we haven't really seen yet.
Our Q&A episodes feature questions from listeners just like you.
So what do you think about the situation with ETBI, which is Activision?
I'm Dave Ahern.
And I'm Andrew Sather.
And we hope you join us on the Investing for Beginners podcast.
On the Investing for Beginners podcast.
I'll confess, sometimes I let my podcast playlist get out of hand and I get way behind. But there's one show that I subscribe to and any new episode goes right to the top of the queue. That's the Jordan Harbinger Show. That's because I never have to figure out, okay, is this one going to be interesting or do I wait for the next one like I do for some shows? Because Jordan's conversations are always a must listen for me. He talks to fascinating people from any category you can think of. Authors, scientists, athletes, you name it. He's talked to undercover cops who posed as mafia and the actual career mafia hitmen. And the stories he gets out of these people, just incredible. In one episode, he talked to Paul Holes. You might know that name if you're into true crime. He's the former investigator who uses really advanced methods to solve cold cases, including the Golden State Killer. And another one I really enjoyed was with Sam Harris, an author and neuroscientist who promotes skepticism, and he doesn't mind taking on some seriously controversial topics like politics or religion. That one's going to make you think. Whenever a new episode of the Jordan Harbinger Show pops up, I already know it's going to be an episode that I'll enjoy listening to, and I'll bet you will too. For some episode recommendations, check out jordanharbinger.com/start. Or search for The Jordan Harbinger Show. That's H-A-R-B as in boy, I-N as in Nancy, G-E-R, on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Imagine unlocking a version of yourself that's unstoppable, where mental barriers no longer hold you back. Listen to Mentally Stronger with me, Amy Morin, therapist and international bestselling author, here to guide you on a journey to reaching your greatest potential. Every Monday, I bring you into conversations with some of the most fascinating minds. Experts, authors, entrepreneurs, athletes, and musicians. They don't just share stories. They reveal the mental strategies that propelled them to the top. But here's the real magic. At the end of each episode, I break down their wisdom into practical, therapist-approved advice. In my solo episodes, I dive deep into the techniques that build mental strength. It's like having your own personal therapy session as you discover how to turn these insights into steps you can take right now. This podcast isn't just for those facing mental health challenges. It's for anyone who wants to push their limits, achieve peak performance, and truly thrive. Are you ready to unlock your full potential? Then it's time to become mentally stronger. Subscribe to Mentally Stronger with therapist Amy Morin, available wherever you love to listen to podcasts.
I was riding through Paterson, New Jersey. Normally, I wouldn't stay in big cities, especially big cities with a lot of crime, because it was dangerous. But I met this wonderful woman named Elizabeth, and she was from Columbia. I met her in front of a grocery store when I was panhandling, and she was concerned about me. And she said, "I'm concerned about you riding through this area. You know, you can stay with me." And I thought, oh my God, this is such a beautiful opportunity. Of course, I'm going to take her up on it. And so Elizabeth, you know, she cooked me dinner in this. She lived in this very small apartment in a rough area of Paterson, New Jersey. And she was sharing all these beautiful stories about growing up in extreme poverty, to where there'd be days where they didn't even have enough money to buy rice. You know, I was capturing that moment with, you know, having dinner with her, and I was feeling so inspired about having this beautiful connection with this stranger, and also just being able to be fortunate to, you know, receive so much kindness from someone was so amazing, you know, and just uplifting. And I'm about to go to sleep at midnight. Her daughter and her boyfriend come home. Her boyfriend instantly is just grilling me with questions, you know, like, what are you doing here? Who are you, et cetera? And then he starts telling me about, you know, how dangerous this neighborhood is because of all the gangs activity that's happening, right? He doesn't trust me. And Elizabeth was saying, no, please, like, he's fine. Let him stay. Leave him alone. But this person gets into my face, and then he shoves me and he says, if you don't leave now, that we're going to have a serious problem. And he takes my stuff and he literally just throws it out into the street. And so at that point, you know, I have no choice. Like, I just got to get out of there. And it was really sad because Elizabeth was crying. You know, she did this really kind act for somebody. And, you know, the boyfriend definitely didn't trust me and want me there and said, okay, I'll leave. And so it's 1 a.m. and I'm riding through Paterson, New Jersey, in literally gang neighborhoods, to where there's people on the street corners, you know, gang members. And I have, you know, this, my bike, I'm wearing bright green. I'm obviously not from there. I have all this gear on my bike. Like,
one thing in this picture that doesn't belong, right?
Exactly. Exactly. Right. And so my first thought is, initially I was like, I want to ride to the next town and get out of here. But then once I was on the street and seeing all the gang members, I thought, I need to get out off of the street like within seconds because I'm going to get robbed or killed or who knows what's going to happen. And so I find this old abandoned warehouse and I ride my bike back there and there's all these abandoned semi trucks and I have a really bad vibe about sleeping back there, but I thought, well, this gets me off the streets. So, you know, I'm just going to have to make with it, you know? So I set up my tent in the corner of this warehouse and, or behind this warehouse. And, you know, I get woken up at 3 a.m. I hear this big truck. And at first I can just hear the engine kind of idling, you know, close to my tent. And so I wake up and I think, what the hell is going on? Like, I have no idea. And then I hear the truck start driving towards me slowly. And my heart rate is just pounding, you know? And again, I can't see what's going on. I just see some lights, you know, going into my tent. And then I hear the engine just revving, driving fast towards my tent. And in that moment, I literally thought, like, I'm getting run over. Like, this is how I die. This is it. And I've never had a moment like that ever in my whole life. And I could just, like, my hands were so sweaty. My heart was racing 100 miles per hour. And then I hear the truck stop right in front of my tent. I hear the door open and close. And then I think, okay, so I'm not getting run over, but I'm going to get murdered or robbed or something's happening. And then the person yells, "Get the fuck out." And at that point, I was so terrified. I've never been this terrified in my whole life because, again, I can't see what's going on. And I just felt stuck in my tent. There's nowhere to go. So,
right. And I should mention this for anyone listening. You recorded yourself in this and it's in the documentary. And yeah, I mean, the fear in your voice and on your face is just obvious.
Yeah. There's this moment where, a friend actually pointed out to me, you can see the complete, if you pause the film, you can see just complete terror in my face. I've never had that expression before ever. So I thought to myself, okay, like he told me to get the fuck out. So I'm going to try to sound as non-confrontational as possible.
And you did. You did that really well.
Thank you. Thank you. And that was a survival tactic. It literally, like, I thought, like, this is what I need to do in this moment. Like, this is an instinctual move in some ways. So I unzip the tent and I say, "Hey," like, you know, lighten up my voice. "Hey, like, I'm Daniel. Like, how's it going?" All I see, I just see two headlights just beaming into my face. And so I can't see the person. So I don't know if the person, where they are. And I don't know, most importantly, if they're holding a gun towards me. They might be pointing a gun at me, and especially, again, considering the fact that this is a gang neighborhood in Paterson, New Jersey. He says, "What are you doing here?" And I just said, I'm talking to these headlights and I'm trying to calm my voice. And I said, I'm just crashing for the night." Absolutely terrifying moment. And then the guy says, "Well, I'm a security guard. You can't be sleeping here." And just, I felt like the weight of the world was just lifted off of my shoulders at that moment. And I realized, okay, this person, they're not here to kill me, but they're just like a person that's patrolling the area. But that moment, just considering all those circumstances, that was extremely traumatizing. And it definitely, I was not the same after, you know, I still had to ride all the way back to California from New Jersey. And after that, like sleeping in all these strange places, it wasn't like an adventure anymore. It just felt scary after that.
What did you learn from this adventure?
Man, there's so much that comes to mind. I mean, the first thing that really stands out to me is there was a lot of people who showed up into my life in moments when I really needed it. Especially as my appearance started to change. You know, one particular story really stands out that's tied into your question is I was in Oregon, and after 7 months, you know, of panhandling and trying to find a safe place to sleep and trying to find a place to bathe and trying to get enough food and money and being physically broken down, just my body was really starting to ache and I was getting harassed more, and that was really wearing on me, and I was just feeling so beaten up. And I was standing on the side of the road just stretching my body, and this was the closest I came to quitting. Was these couple of days. And I remember thinking, like, I don't think I want to go on anymore. I'm just too exhausted. And this person walks up to me, and his name was Gary. And everybody else is walking by. I don't have my sign out. I'm not asking for anything. And Gary picks up on the energy that I'm putting out. And he says, "Hey, man, are you okay?" I said, "Yeah, man, I'm just kind of having a rough couple of days." He says, "Hold on a second, man. I want, just stay here for a second. And he runs across the street to a grocery store. And Gary comes back and he has a bag full of groceries. And he gives me a bag full of groceries. And I wasn't asking for it. Again, my sign wasn't out. But Gary picked up on the energy that I was putting out. I said, thank you, man. And I start asking him his story. Where are you from, man? Where do you live? What's your story? He says, I live on the streets. I'm homeless. And I said, what made you want to help me? He said, because you looked like you're going through a rough time. And Gary, I truly believe that Gary, because he'd faced a lot of hardships in his life, he was able to pick up on the energy when everybody else was passing by, and he recognized the energy. And the thing is, it wasn't about the food or money, because I actually had some food that day. It was the fact that he saw that I was struggling, and he showed up for me. And that's what I learned, is every day we all have this like super incredible opportunity to show up for somebody. And it doesn't have to be giving food or money to someone who's homeless. It could be someone you work with. If you can tell their energy's off, you know, just checking in with them. Because that moment for me, like, Gary changed my life, just showing me that. And it's really cool, because I think, holy shit, we can all be that person who shows up for somebody and we can change their life. And that's really cool that, like, there's so much chaos in our world right now, but like one thing that we can always control, that we actually can control, is how we treat each other. And we can all be a Gary to somebody.
Yeah. And that was kind of the premise for this whole thing, right? I mean, there's so much chaos in the world and everybody's fighting each other, but there's still a lot of good people in this world. That encounter was proof of it.
Yeah, I totally agree with you, you know, and that's another thing I learned from this experience is, you know, like, you know, watching the news and listening to politicians and all the fear mongering that's happening with all this. When you go out into these communities and you actually talk to people, especially people who are different, you know, I think it's really beneficial to learn, to give them a chance to speak and listen to them. And then you have a better understanding. And then I think that there's two things that happen is first of all, I think there's less fear of those people who are different. And then you realize, you know, maybe we're not that different. That's another thing I learned from this. Cause a lot of times I was going into neighborhoods that I normally wouldn't go into. And I was speaking to people who had different opinions, but it was so inspiring because I realized, you know, we're actually not that different.
Have you ever thought about doing this again?
I have. Yeah. And I go back and forth in it because, you know, it's interesting. Just yesterday I was talking to this homeless man. He was panhandling on the street. And now when I see people, I always just like, I want to hear their stories, because living this lifestyle for 7 months, like, it created so many interesting, unique opportunities that's so different than normal life. And this man, he said he was 45 years old. He said he'd been homeless since he was 8 years old, because his mom used to beat him. And he said that, I was like, well, how were you getting by at eight? He's like, man, he was like, it was the 80s. He said, I would go and I would tell people I needed a quarter to call my parents. And that's how he would panhandle. He'd say, I need to use the payphone. He'd been homeless for 37 years. And the amount of stories this person had was unbelievable. And it was interesting. I said, well, do you eventually want to get into housing? And he told me, he said, that would be a waste of my life. He's like, why would I go into housing now? He said, this is what my life is meant to be. I'm meant to be out here.
That's his normal.
This is normal. And in some ways, it's really interesting because I, you know, life is kind of how you look at it. And I thought, you know, he brought the example. He's like, well, is working in an office, that's a normal day, you know, job. He said, but I'm living in a more instinctual way. And I thought, that's pretty interesting to think about. And I'm tying that in because I have thought about doing it again, just for the sake of, man, so many unpredictable things happen. And there's this crazy opportunity when you're really just going with the flow and just letting kind of the journey take its own route. It leads you on a lot of really beautiful experiences. And I think that it really gets you connected and present in the moment.
Yeah. And you were thinking about, after 7 months, you were worn out and tired and didn't want to keep going. But I mean, there's people that's their life. They don't have any choice.
Yeah. Yeah. And I can't even imagine how difficult it is for those people who are living that life every day. Can't even imagine.
For people that want to watch your documentary and your website, how can they find all that?
Thank you for asking. So, So my film, which is called We Are All in This Together, it's streaming on Amazon Prime, on Apple TV, and Google Play. My website is weareallinthistogethermovie.com. And what I'd like to share is in a couple of months, I'm going to be hitting the road and I'm going to be going to different cities across America and having live screenings of my movie in different theaters. We're going to be using the ticket sales from those showings to raise money for the local homeless shelters in the city that we're riding through. And so, I'd love to encourage anybody to check out the website. There'll be a list of dates on there that talk about what cities I'm going through, and would love, you know, it'd be really cool to meet a listener, you know, maybe we can go for a bike ride or go for a walk and, you know, and share some nice stories with each other and also talk about the podcast, you know, talk about how we're both fans of this podcast. Cause I've been listening to this podcast. I actually came across this podcast, when I was traveling in Europe last year.
Really? I didn't know that. Okay.
Yeah, so it's pretty cool, man. I've been a fan of the podcast, and it's a huge honor to be on here with you.
Well, it's an honor to have you here. And, you know, you're going across the country. I assume you're not biking across the country. This is in a car or something, right?
Yeah, I was tempted to do the bike ride, but I can hit way more cities in the car. So
yeah, for sure. And I know you're coming to Florida, and wherever you're coming to Florida, I want to know about it. I'm going to sign up and, you know, make sure I'm aware of when you're here, because, yeah, I definitely want to meet up with you and go to the screening, and any listeners that are here, that'll be fun. Get together.
Absolutely. Yeah. That's what it's all about, connecting and supporting each other, right?
For sure. And, you know, you and I are a lot alike in that we both have a big heart for the homeless population. I do a lot of work with them here locally as well. What a great thing to be able to do that. Just go across the country, show your movie to people, raise money, help the homeless people. You got the ideal life now, I think.
Thank you. And I can't say enough about just the people that I met along the way. You know, they helped create this story, and it kind of goes in line with, you know, as far as the movie tour. Like when I left, I didn't know what I was doing as far as making a movie. And I would love to share with the listeners, you know, I hardly had any film experience at all. I didn't know what I was doing. I was learning on the road. But I think that, you know, sometimes if you have a creative idea, just go for it, because you never know what could happen. And for me personally, sometimes I would have like self-doubt about certain things creatively, because I thought, oh, I don't have any experience with that, so I won't be any good. But, you know, this bike ride taught me that you don't have to have experience. You just got to go for it.
Yeah, I was surprised when I went to your website. I mean, the number of awards this film has won, and you just keep scrolling and scrolling, and it's really gotten a lot of them.
Thank you so much. And I mean, it's so incredible. Just to be able to share your art by itself is amazing. And then the idea of winning is a huge honor. And again, that's why I can't say enough about like these people I met, man. I'm so grateful, because like them sharing their stories, like we all did it together. We all did it. It wasn't just me, you know, it was those people who decided to be kind to me and to show up into my life. And then all of a sudden this story is out there. And in some ways I'm so happy, because it gets to celebrate them, because they definitely deserve it.
I really enjoyed having that conversation with Daniel. He's such a genuine, down-to-earth person. And I'm hoping to meet him in person in the not-too-distant future, because one of the cities he's planning to visit in his movie tour is St. Pete, Florida. He hasn't yet finalized all the dates and the various cities he'll be visiting to screen the movie, but you can check his website for up-to-date information, and you can also email him. I'll have links to his website and his email address in the episode notes at whatwasthatlike.com/174.
Hi, Scott. My name is Amy. I'm listening to the re-release of the episode Justin Found His Mother on Facebook. I am tearing up listening to it, because I had the same exact experience a couple of years ago. I was adopted before I was even born. My birth mother had decided she couldn't keep me for the same reasons as Justin's mother. Didn't have the resources to give me the life that she wanted, and grew up with a family that was very different than my personality. Very awesome people, very kind, gave me everything I needed to care of me, but it never felt like I had a mirror for who I am and my personality and my quirks, and, you know, had never seen anyone that looked like me. And my heart always yearned and ached to know the biological family. And I finally had the courage to try to find I found my mother on Facebook a few years before I even tried to contact her. I had to work up the courage to send her a message. So I finally sent her a message. I think the same thing happened where it went to that inbox on Facebook when you're not friends with someone. And, you know, my mother's probably in her 50s and couldn't figure that out for a while. So a year later, on the day that I was graduating from massage school, the very day that I was graduating, I got home and saw that she had replied. And yeah, it's just crazy. And I just relate to everything that Justin is saying, all of the feelings. And it's nice to hear someone else talk about it, because I don't know a lot of people that are adopted, and don't know a lot of people that are adopted who have had positive stories reconnecting with their birth family. And Justin's reminds me of my own very much. I finally met my birth mom a couple of years ago. I flew out to the Midwest from the East Coast to meet my birth mom, my half siblings, because she had a couple of kids after me, my uncles, my birth grandfather, my birth grandmother, cousins. So cool. And they were all so kind, and just to be finally feel the resonance of like people who not only look like me, even though that's big, but it's just a certain feeling when you're around people that you come from and that you're related to. I realized finally that it's actually very special to be adopted, because you know, if you grow up with your biological family, whoever you grow up with, you have a tendency to get annoyed by, and we get under each other's skin, and you see the good and the bad, and it can be harder to sometimes appreciate those who are close to us day in and day out. Not that we don't love them, but you know what I mean. I feel like I met my birth family, it's like we don't have that day in and day out frustration with each other. We just have this like blank slate to build a positive relationship on. And also it has made me appreciate my birth family more. And it's like I have two families that love me equally, and I love them equally. My heart feels so full after a lifetime of feeling really lonely and ununderstood and lost and kind of hurt, and like I didn't know who I was, and I had no reference for my identity, which was really, really hard. And I felt that way for as long as I can remember. It's like a reward after going through all of that is that I now know who I am, and I have two families to love. So I hope that there's more people out there who have had the same experience, and thank you so much for listening to me and for sharing the stories that you do. God bless Justin and his birth mom and newfound family.
If you haven't heard that episode yet, it's episode 170, and it came out on March 15, 2024, and it's titled Justin Found His Mother on Facebook. And we have a new Raw Audio episode. Raw Audio 40 just went live. The Raw Audio series are bonus exclusive episodes that include actual 911 audio and the stories that go with that call. In this episode, you'll hear a man calling because his mother can't breathe, and he calls more than once.
Sorry, say that again?
Tell me exactly what happened.
She's struggling to breathe.
Okay.
A husband and wife are surprised when someone's trying to break into their home.
He can only shoot him if he comes in, right?
And a man calls to turn himself in and get help for the elderly couple he was holding hostage.
First of all, I'm a piece of shit. I need medical assistance out here for this elderly couple. I'm turning myself in.
You can binge all 40 episodes when you sign up to support the podcast. And not just that, you get to listen to all the What Was That Like episodes without any ads. And you can try it for free. If you're listening on an iPhone, just go to What Was That Like and click on Try Free. On Android, go to whatwasthatlike.com/plus to try it out. Graphics for this episode were created by Bob Bretz. Full episode transcription was created by James Lai. And it's time for the listener story. You're going to hear this story because a listener, just like you, said, hey, I had something interesting happen to me. Why don't I record that in a little 5 or 10 minute story on my phone and send it to Scott? And that's what they did. And that's what you should do. Just record a story of something that happened to you and email it to me at scott@whatwasthatlike.com. This week's story is about a scary encounter at the grocery store. Stay safe, and I'll see you next time.
April 23rd, 2018 started off as a typical busy Monday morning for me. The kids had school at 8, and I was due to work at 9. My husband wasn't home because he was working as a truck driver and he was out of town. I was having my morning coffee and getting ready to make the kids their lunches when I realized we were out of lunch meat. I thought, oh no, I have to make their lunches, and how am I going to do this? Because I also realized we were out of milk and they're going to want their cereal. So I thought to myself, okay, well, Albertson's supermarket is just down the street. I will go get dressed for work, run down there, get it, and be back. So I'm in getting dressed, which turns out to be a pretty important in this story because it ended up saving my life. I'm a dog groomer at the time, and when you're grooming dogs, there is a lot of hair. And I really wanted to wear my leggings because they're so comfy, but I knew that they would just get so hairy because whenever I got done working, it looked like I came out of a blizzard of hair. So I just threw my jeans on and thought, this'll do. My son's just getting out of the shower, and I tell him, hey, your little sister's still sleeping. I'm going to run down to Albertson's to get milk and lunch meat. I'll be right back. So I head out to the car, and I remember thinking, oh my God, I don't have my cell phone. But then I thought, well, that's fine because I'll be right back. It was still on the charger from the night before. I pulled into the parking lot and I was really happy there weren't that many people there. And I thought, oh, good. I can make it in and out and I can get on with my day. I got the milk, went to the lunch aisle, the lunch meat aisle, and I'm like, okay, which kind am I going to get? There are so many different kinds. Do I want turkey? Do I want ham? Next thing I know, I look down the aisle and there's a man coming, a much older man. And I thought to myself, oh, I'll just move out of the way because I could tell he wanted to go look at the same place I was. He was looking at lunch meat. And I was just standing there and he said, excuse me, do you know what time it is? I said, oh my gosh, sir, I'm so sorry. I don't have my cell phone. And I was like, I do know it's probably about 6:15 because the store just opened. And before I could even get anything else out, he like lunged at me and hit me in the stomach. And I'm like, it was terrifying. Like, it was so traumatic. It hurt so bad. It was like a stinging, stabbing, like pain. And like when you get punched, like in the gut, that's kind of what it felt like. And I was like, oh my God. And I kind of looked up at him and I started to cry. And I said, why would you do that? Why would you punch me? And he looked at me and said, and he held up his hand and I saw a knife and he said, I just stabbed you. And I was like, oh my God. So I'm like running because he's coming after me. He is like running after me up and down the aisles, trying to find somebody. I'm screaming. I'm sitting there thinking, where is help? And finally I get down the end of one aisle and I see a worker. It was a man that was working in the meat department. And I ran up to him, sir, please, oh my God, please help me. This man just hit me and he's following me. He's chasing me. And the meat man, but when I was telling him, he turned and there's the crazy old man just like staring at us at the end of the aisle. And he stepped in front of me, the meat man did, to protect me. And he said, sir, what is the problem? And the man said, I stabbed her and I will stab you too. And I'm at this point just like going hysterical because I'm like, what is going on? The man gets on his walkie-talkie, says something. Next thing you know, two other workers come and the man by this point is flailing the knife around in the air. They knock the knife down. They knock him to the ground. After that, the meat man turned to me and he said, ma'am, are you okay? And I'm thinking, no, I'm not okay. You know, this crazy guy, old man, just punched me. And the guy said, are you sure he didn't stab you? And I'm like, no. And I look down and there's blood. At this point, I am freaking out, screaming, crying. The man's grabbing towels to help me. And then the police come, they question me, they question the guy. The guy's still yelling, I stabbed her and I will stab you too. Like, it is insane. Then the ambulance comes and they take me to the hospital. Luckily, the knife only went in about an inch and a half. The doctor did tell me that what saved my life was the waistband of my jeans. So had I worn those leggings that day, the knife would have gone all the way in. And I mean, I could have died. And it's still so shocking to this day, you know, that happened. And they did have to do a lot of stitches. I was happy that they did charge the man with felony assault with a weapon. Turns out he was 74. About a week later, I did find out they sentenced him to Warm Springs State Psychiatric Hospital here in Montana because they did find him mentally ill, which isn't surprising. The only thing that I found really awkward, the police questioned him of why he did this, and he said that he was homeless and that he was very angry at the VA. I still to this day do not know what would push somebody to go hurt somebody else because of that, but I'm just so grateful that I made it and that I'm okay. The police did call my sister, so she was able to come take care of my kids for me while I was going through everything. Very traumatic. Lucky to be alive. Much more aware of my surroundings. Lots of therapy. But I'm okay. And that's like the main thing of this whole story is this happened, but I'm okay. Even now, my coworkers every year, we celebrate my stabiversary on April 23rd. They usually get me a cake from the Albertsons I was stabbed at. Usually they'll say something like, "We're so glad you survived." And I just take it as that. I'm okay. And I'm so thankful.
Hey, this is Scott. Did you know we offer a premium feed of this show that is completely ad-free and there are bonus episodes? Go to whatwasthatlike.com/plus or just click the link in the show notes of any episode to learn more and to sign up. If you're listening on Apple Podcasts, you can sign up right there in the app by clicking Try Free at the top of the episode list. And I hope to see you in the premium feed soon.